Maseches Peah, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Aleph, 3:1. The Mishnah returns to discuss the definition of a field and whether if there's the same crop growing in two fields that are separated with a space in the middle, if they're considered one or two fields. As we said in the beginning of the previous Perek, if the field is divided into two separate fields legally, then a separate Peah must be left for each of those two legally separate fields. So the Mishnah here is talking about a specific case where a person has an orchard, he has trees growing in his property, and he wants to also plant grain. So the grain, of course, can't be planted directly up to the trees, so he will plant grain in like patches around the trees. So the question is, should we look at those patches as being individual patches and each one needs its own Peah, or is it one big grain field that just has interruptions because the trees are there? And that's perfectly normal. It's perfectly normal to have trees first and not cut down the trees, but just to utilize the rest of the space to grow grain. So the main point of the Mishnah, although it's hidden away, the main point of the Mishnah is that if there are a lot of trees, then we look at those trees as just causing an interruption, and a person intended to have one single field, but because of the inconvenience of having trees in the middle and needing to give them space so the trees can nourish themselves properly and so the, you know, the farmer can get around the field comfortably and conveniently with his equipment. So the spaces between the different patches are just there for the sake of the trees, but really his intention is to have a single unified field of grain. On the other hand, if there are very few trees and yet he decides to make separate patches of grain, so it's clear that it's not the trees that force him to make separate patches, but rather that he just wants separate patches and the trees aren't the reason why. So the Mishnah now is going to discuss the question of exactly at what density of trees are the trees considered to be a good reason to be dividing up a good excuse, we'll call it, for dividing up your field into separate patches. And really it's one single contiguous patch conceptually just broken up by the trees. So again, everyone will agree, if there's a low density of trees and you make it to patches, then clearly you want the separate patches. If there's a high density of trees and they are the reason why, and everyone can see that the patches are because of the trees, so then it'll be clear be considered a single field for Peah purposes, and the breaks are because of the trees. The question is, what about a middle case? Where do you draw the line between the trees are too dense and that's what's forcing you to separate the separate patches unintentionally? And when do you say the trees aren't that dense? And if you're keeping separate patches, it must be because you want specifically separate patches. So the Mishnah will say that the dividing line, the exact middle case, is when you have 10 trees in total in a space of land that's called a base saw. A base saw is an area that's 50 by 50 square amos, an amo being one's arm length from elbow to the tip of his middle finger. So 50 amos is roughly 25 meters, roughly 75 feet on a side. So in an area that's a base saw, 2,500 square amos, if he has 10 trees precisely out throughout that field, then we will call that the borderline case. And there's a machlokus and that borderline case between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai say already at the borderline case of 10 trees per base saw, then already he must leave separate payas for each one. And Beis Hillel say no, at 10 trees per base saw, that's the threshold, but still one can leave one Peah for all of his fields. That's the whole Mishnah outside. The Mishnah inside is much less expansive and also not so clear what it's talking about. Here's what the Mishnah says. Malbonos hatavua shebein hazesim. If you have squares or rectangles of grain amongst the trees, zesim here means olives, olive trees, but there's no magic to olives. We're just picking a tree that's other than a grape, so that we don't have an issue of kilayim. Beishame omrim peah mikol echad be'echad. Beishame requires a separate peah on each and every patch. But again, the explanation here is that their density is exactly 10 trees for every base saw. And at that point, Beishame requires one peah for each and every patch. And of course, if there are fewer than 10 trees per base saw and you still kept separate patches, all the more so, each patch needs its own peah. And Beishil omrim me'echad v'alakol. Beis Hillel say no, if you have 10 trees per base saw, then you can look at those trees as being just very dense and getting in your way. And really, conceptually, all the different patches are really one big field, and you can leave one peah for the whole field. And of course, that's true for 11 or 12 trees per beisah, all the more so is the trees that are in the way. And that's why your single field is really divided up, sort of against your will, so to speak. And therefore, one peah will be suffice for the whole thing. Umodim, they both agree. Shimhayo roshe shuros moravin. They all agree that if part of the edges of some of the, of one patch, one malben, one square of grain touches another patch, square of grain, so that means, of course, it's like sort of contiguous where the edges touch, then everyone agrees, shehu nosen peah me'echad al hakol, then everyone agrees, meaning Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai both agree, that you're showing that you want it really conceptually to be one contiguous field that happens to be broken up in patches because of the trees, and therefore, you're allowed, according to everybody, nosen peah me'echad al hakol, you're allowed to leave one peah for all the separate patches. Rolling Maseches Peah, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Beis, 3-2. Hamnamares Sedehu, if a person harvests his field in a way that it resembles patchwork. A nemer is a leopard. So manamer means it can make like leopard spots, if you will, in his field. That means, for example, that he has a field where most of the grain ripened, but there are certain patches that weren't ripened yet. So he harvested what was ripe. That means it's dried out already. And that which is still moist, those stalks he leaves till later on when they'll be ready. So then when he leaves the harvest at after stage one, he's got patches left in his field of unharvested grain. So Hamanamaris Sadehu, one who leaves his field with spots, Vishir Kalachim Lachim, he leaves those moist stalks for later. The question is, does he have to leave separate peahs on those patches, or can he look at this as just one long harvest and leave peah on the entire field from those patches? So Rabbi Kiva Omer, Nosin Peah Mikol Echad Ve'echad. Rabbi Kiva says it's as if there's two separate harvests. So after the first harvest of the main part of the field, he'll leave a peah. Then these separate patches, when he harvests them, he'll leave peah on each and every one of them. The Chacham Omrim Me'echad Al Hakol. The rabbis say, and this is the halacha, that no, it's just one long process, and he can ultimately leave peah on the whole field when he harvests the later patches. Umodim Chachamim. The rabbis, however, agree. The Rabbi Akiva. To Rabbi Akiva, Bezorea Sheves O Chardol B'Shlosha Makomos. If one has planted Sheves is dill, and chardal is mustard. And now the Mishnah literally translates if he planted dill or mustard in three places. But the pshat in the Mishnah, according to the Bar Tanur and most Mefarshim, is that he planted a large field of dill or a large field of mustard. But after he harvested, it looks as if he had, from the outset to an onlooker, as if he planted little patches of dill, little patches of mustard, because that's a normal thing to do. So, meaning, when it comes to wheat or barley, etc., when it comes to grain, it's not normal to plant little patches. And therefore, an onlooker will know what's happening. He'll see that he left the patches still to ripen. But when it comes to mustard and dill, it's normal to plant little patches. And therefore, an onlooker will see these patches as being, assume these patches were planted that way from the beginning. And therefore, they will assume that when the farmer harvests these patches later on and doesn't leave peah, that the farmer isn't leaving peah. And that's, of course, not okay. And therefore, the rabbis agree, at least midrabanan, that when it comes to sheves and chardal, dill and mustard, in three separate places, shunosin peah mikol echad ve'echad, that he should still leave peah on each and every patch when he harvests it later on, midrabanan, so people shouldn't think he's cheating peah. This would apply to any type of produce that one does normally plant in little patches. If he ends up having these patches later on, because of how it looks, he should leave separate peahs for each and every patch. As far as the reason why I chose these particular examples then of Sheves and Chardal, it's because normally one only plants little patches of Yirakos, of vegetables, like a vegetable patch. And when it comes to Yirakos, normally there is no peah to be left because a Yerek, a vegetable, is not Machnisa Lakium. When you harvest it, it doesn't last. So they're exempt. But when it comes to dill and mustard, it's not true because both of those you harvest for the seed. Mustard you harvest from mustard seed, and mustard seed can be Mukuyam does last in storage. As far as dill goes, of course, that green leafy stuff, that the dill weed, does not last. It goes, dries out very quickly. But dill is also harvested for its seeds, dill seed. And it's a thing, believe it or not. You can buy it today in the stores. You can Google dill seed and get it. So since people also wanted the dill seeds, and the seeds do store, That is a crop that a person would plant in small amounts, and therefore if he planted a large field of it, and then these patches later on, he leaves a separate payah for each and every patch. Meseches Peah, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Gimel, 3:3. Hamachalik betalim lachim lashuk umakayim yveishim lagorin. If a person harvests his onions while they're moist to take to market, and he leaves mekayim, he maintains the yveishim, the dry ones, for the shuk. Now the word machalik has a few pshatim here. It's a strange word. The two pshatim basically that the bartender brings either is from the word to make smooth, like chalak. So machalik is a like hay field to cause to be smooth. That is to say that the field, when it comes to onions, have lots of greens poking out the ground. And when you harvest the onions, what's left behind is nothing. So the ground becomes smooth. So it's being like as if you're smoothing out the field. And therefore, there's a special verb for harvesting onions, machalik. The other pshat is like it's a lashon related to mechalek, to divide into two separate chalakim, two separate portions. So either way, again, the Mishnah is saying if a person's harvesting his onions in two stages, and the first stage he takes, for argument's sake, half the onions while they're still moist, and those are better for sale in the marketplace, and others he leaves in the ground where he's mekayim them until they grow drier, because once they're dry they'll store better. So he treats it as if they're almost two different crops. Then it's analogous to we had the case before of two subspecies of wheat, say, where you treat them separately. You treat it as two separate crops in terms of the halachas of peah. So here too, Nosin peah le'elul atzman u'elul atzman. He'll leave two separate peahs, meaning when he takes the first half as the first harvest for the lachim, the moist ones that are going to the shuk to sell in the market, those he will leave a peah on. And then when he makes a second harvest some weeks or months later, collecting the yevashim, the dry ones, he'll make a second peah all over again. V'chein ba'afunim, v'chein ba'kerim. Same goes with afunim, some kind of bean. Perhaps those are garbanzo beans or chickpeas, same thing. In any case, the point is, I guess they go in two varieties. There's a moist way to eat them and a dry way to eat them, or they work well being sold moist and later on they're saved dry. Whatever the case, if he has such a produce of beans where he has them in two stages, he'll leave two separate payas, one for each stage. The chen bekerem, same goes in a vineyard. It's common to harvest one's grapes early in the season and then leave late harvest grapes later on. Late harvest grapes are much sweeter, and they're better for like dessert wines and raisins and so. So he treats them as two separate crops because he has, you know, the same species of grape, but they're for different end games and therefore like two different harvests, and therefore he'll leave two separate payas. New thought. The Mishnah says, Hamedel, if one thins out his onion field, that is to say that he planted his onions very densely in the field, and kind of analogous to how one prunes a tree, taking away some of the fruit so the other ones will grow more fully. Here he's plucking out early some of the onions and the remaining onions will grow more fully. And the question is, when one does that, must he leave peah based on the total amount that grew originally, or only how much is left after he thins them out? So for argument's sake, let's say he had 120 square meters worth of onions, but he pulls out half of them, leaving, let's say, 60 square meters worth of onions. The question is, does he leave 1 square meter or 2 square meters worth of onions as peah? And the answer is, the Mishnah says, Hamedel, if one does thin out, since he's benefiting himself and the unequal to get healthy onions, Nosin min hamishayr al mashashir, he leaves on what he leaves behind, he leaves peah on what he leaves behind, on what he left behind, meaning what was plucked out early in the Medel process doesn't go into the calculations of what is left for peah, because everyone benefits from those he pulled away. And those also, by the way, wouldn't be eligible for pay altogether because they're probably not machnis and akiyah, and they wouldn't store very well. They're still premature, undeveloped onions. The Mishnah continues, Hamachalik me'achas yad. The bartender understands his preferred pshat here is this means, literally means one plucks his onions out with a single hand, but it means for a single purpose. That is to say, he might have the harvest in two separate stages over time. He'll harvest the onions now and half he'll do in a month's time, like the first case of the Mishnah. But in the first case of the Mishnah, he had two different endpoints. The first early harvest, the onions were going to shuk, to the marketplace, and the ones he harvested later on were dried out and there for storage. Here, he's harvesting them for the same purpose, meaning he's harvesting half now and half in a month's time. Remember, onions will stay well in the ground, so it's sort of like refrigeration, so to speak, preserving the onions. But his end game is both the same for both batches, either to the shuk for sale or for a storage, since it's for machlik ma'achas yad, for a single purpose. Nosin min mishar al hakol, he'll leave one peah at the end, and what he left for the second half of the harvest, he'll leave a peah on that portion. He'll harvest a second on what he harvested on both fields, both harvests combined. So again, for argument's sake, if he had 120 square meters worth of onions, and he harvested 60 now when they're moist, and he harvests 60 later in a month's time, but he's also for the same purpose. When he harvests the second 60, he'll leave 2 square meters at the end as payah for the entire crop together. Maseches Peah, Per Gimel, Mishnah Dalad 3-4. To understand this mission, you have to understand how onions grow. Onions are a biennial crop, B-I-E-N-N. Biennial means that the onion has a 2-year cycle. Normally, we plant a certain crop in the same year that we harvest it, but onions are different. Onions in year one, you plant the seed, and the onion develops a small little plant, but basically it grows the bulb underground. And that bulb will act as like a battery pack, a store of energy, where in year two, out of that bulb will grow a new plant, and out of that plant on the top will be the little flowers that produce all the onion seeds. Meaning, after year one, there's no onion seeds, only after year two. So the normal thing to do is to plant onion, then after the first year, pluck out those nice big juicy bulbs before there's ever any seed-bearing flowers coming out of it. That's great. But if you want to get onion seeds so you can plant for the next year, you'll need to wait 2 years. Now, in the second year, you have onion seeds from the little flowers that come out of the onion bulb in the ground, but that onion bulb, which got very big, got depleted. The juice got sucked out of it as the battery was used up to produce the nice big onion flower and all the onion seeds. So what's left in the ground is the mommy of those seeds, the ima, if you will, the mommy of the onion, but it's been depleted and is sort of like very undesirable to eat. So it's only ne'achal al yadei chak. It's only edible in trying circumstances, meaning normally a person would not want to eat such an onion, the second year onion, because it's already kind of mushy and been depleted with nutrients and also doesn't taste and look and feel very good. The question is, therefore, if one does eat those imahos shel betzalim, those mother of onions, those second year large but depleted, mushy, and rather undesirable, untasty onions, does he treat that as a crop that needs to have pay or not? So the Mishnah says, ha'imahos shel betzalim, the mothers of the onions, meaning the second year onion bulb, chayavos papaya. Yes, indeed, you must leave peah for them, even though they're nechal ayadei chak, even though they're rather undesirable, they're human food, and if you're eating them, you're eating them, they're food. But Rabbi Yossi poter. Rabbi Yossi says, no, they're not the kind of food people normally eat, and therefore they are not conforming to the requirement of ochel, one of the 5 requirements of for peah, and therefore they are exempt from peah. Halacha is, however, like the Tanakhama, that one must leave peah if he's eating his, harvesting his imahos shel betzalim. The Mishnah continues, Malbanos habetzalim shebein hayerek. If you have patches, a malban in modern Hebrew is a rectangle, but its origins are from the square mold that one makes bricks in. So it's a malban. In any case, so one has a patch of onions, and between the one patch and another patch of onions, he has yirakot, he has vegetables, I don't know what, cabbage, parsley, whatever it is, growing there. So we had said previously in Mishnah 2:1, that if you have zera acher, a different kind of produce growing between two patches, then each patch has a separate peah. The thing is, here, these yirakot don't have a din of peah at all. So the question is, by having a weird patch of some other greenery between your onions, do you look at the onions as one contiguous field with some imaginary interruption, so to speak, which you can discount? Or no, since there's a real crop growing between the two patches, it's like 2 separate patches altogether, requiring 2 separate payas. And the Mishnah says, Malbanos habetzalim, if you have patches of onions, shebein hayarek, that are amongst the different patches of vegetables, Rabbi Yossi omer peya mikol echad ve'echad. Rabbi Yossi says, each patch of greenery breaks up the patches of onions, so you have like many onion patches, each requiring its own peya. V'chacham omrim, the rabbis say, no, me'echad ala kol. We can discount the existence of the vegetables and leave one peah on the entire onion patch, even though it's not contiguous. We don't look at it as being zera acher, a different kind of crop, because that crop doesn't have peah, so it doesn't count in terms of the halachas of zera acher for peah. And that's the halacha. Maseches Peah, Per Gimel, Mishnah Hey. This Mishnah comes to answer the question about what happens if a field or a tree is owned by multiple people, let's say 2 partners. Is one peah or 2 peah left? Again, we're assuming here that the field is contiguous, it has one type of produce, etc. So to understand this Mishnah, one has to understand that when it comes to shutfus, partnership in Jewish law, the basic notion is that both partners own the entire thing that's owned, in this case a field. So both own the whole field together, as opposed to each owning half the field. Let me explain. So in modern terms, let's say, for example, there's a duplex building and two of us are partners in that building. So the way it would probably work is that the building is owned by an LLC and each of us have a 50% membership interest in the LLC. And then let's say, for example, that the bottom floor is $1,000 in rent and the top floor collects $2,000 in rent. So then we'll collect a total of $3,000 in rent that will go to the LLC, which we own in partnership. And then we'll divide it between the two of us, each of us getting $1,500. There is, of course, another way that we could own the building together. And that is that, for argument's sake, I own the bottom floor and you own the top floor or rights to the top and bottom floor. And then if the rent is $1,000 for the bottom floor and $2,000 for the top floor, then I would get $1,000 because I own the bottom floor and you own independently the top floor, you get $2,000. So that's not a partnership. That's just owning the building and dividing it in half, me having part and you having part. So the Mishnah here says, Ha'achin shechalku, if two brothers had a field together, let's say they inherited a field from their father, and then they divide it. Let's say, for example, one brother gets the north half and one brother takes the southern half of the field, then no stinch day pales. Even though the field is contiguous, there's no divider between the north and south, and it's a single species and it was planted by the same person. Since when it comes to harvesting, that's when the obligation of pay kicks in. I own one half and you own another half, or the two brothers own two separate halves of this field, they'll leave two separate pails. Chazur v'nishtatfu, if they then return to becoming shutfin, partners in the field, that is to say, they both own the whole field together, then since it's co-owned, nosen peya achas, a single pail will suffice for the field. Shnaim shalakhu esa ilan, if two people purchase a tree together, so then nosen peya achas, since they owe the tree together, it's like owning the duplex together, they'll leave a single peya on the whole tree. But if, for argument's sake, laka zetzafonu vazed romo, if one person says, I want the rights to the northern half of the tree and the fruit it produces, and the other one says, I'll get the fruit that is produced on the southern half of the tree. That's kind of like me taking the basement, the bottom floor of the duplex, and you taking the upper floor. So then since we have two separate owners on this tree, one for the north, one for the south, then zenos and pe alatmo, then the owner of the north leaves pe on his northern half of the tree, the single tree, vizenos and pe alatmo, and this person who owns the southern half the tree will leave a separate pay on his southern half of the tree, even though it's a single tree. Two payas, since there are two separate owners. New case in the Mishnah now. This case, the Mishnah is where there's a person who owns a field full of trees and he sells individual trees, but not the land between them to a purchaser. So, hamocher kilche ilan betoch sadeo. If a person sells the stalks of trees within his field. So then the purchaser now is intending to essentially uproot these individual trees and let's say and re-transplant them in his orchard elsewhere. But before he transplants them, let's say he wants to harvest the fruit that are now on the tree. So the question is, will he leave one paya on his trees or a separate paya on each individual tree? Now, since he doesn't own the land between the trees, there's nothing to unite them. Therefore, he has like separate as if separate fields, separate islands of ownership. And therefore, nosin peya mikol echad ve'echad. Each and every tree needs a separate peya left on it because there's nothing that unites them to be a single orchard. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amasai. Rabbi Yehuda says, when does this apply? This Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amasai phrase shows up a number of times throughout Shas. And the Gemara speaks out that what Rabbi Yehuda is doing in all those cases is not arguing, but rather defining the case, clarifying the parameters of the case. So here, Rabbi Yehuda says, when does it apply that the purchaser of individual trees within a field leaves a pair for each and every tree? That's bizman shlo shir bal hasadeh. That's when the owner of the field doesn't retain any of the field trees for himself. He's selling all the trees. And therefore, there's nothing that he has nothing to do with it. Aval im shir bal hasadeh, if the owner of the field retains some trees for himself, and the truth is, as the bartender speaks out, it must be that he started harvesting the fruit on the trees in his field, and therefore automatically all the trees are a package deal, and there'll be a single pail left on all those. So then, who knows in pail a kol? He, the owner of the field, will leave paya on the entire field, meaning for argument's sake, if there are 60 trees, he'll leave one tree worth of paya, even though some of the 60 trees individually are being sold to this other person. since this other person came late to the party, meaning after the harvest began. So then the pay has been unified over the entire area that's being harvested, and therefore the Baal Hasadeh, the owner of the entire field, is responsible for leaving payah. But again, if the harvest hadn't started yet, and then this person came and he wanted to buy individual trees for transplantation into his backyard, so then he would, if he harvests those trees prior to transplanting them, he would need to leave a separate payah on each and every tree. Maseches Peah, Per Gimel, Mishnah Vav, 3:6. This Mishnah is asking, what is the minimum size of a field that would be required to leave payah? So we'll have in total 5 different shirim. Each one is getting smaller than the next. So we start with the largest, and then we go down in size. And the basis of each of these opinions is really based on different drushas that are linking the idea of a sada, a field, which is a requirement for not to harvest your field to the edge by payah, and then trying to link that idea of a field to other contexts in the halachas of gifts to the poor. So we'll see inside. It says, Rabbi Eliezer Omer. The first opinion is Rabbi Eliezer's, and he says, Karka base rova chayevas papeya. Land the size of what's called a base rova, that's the minimum size of a field that will be obligated in payah. Base rova means literally a house of a rova. A rova is a quarter of a kav. The way I think it's most useful to at least keep in your mind the size of these various volumes in the Mishnah is as follows. The most common measure of volume is the kav. So the kav, you can imagine as being a 2-liter bottle of water, and the kav is approximately 2 liters. So there are 6 kavin in a sa'a. A sa'a is a larger measurement. So you can imagine a 6-pack. You know, you buy a 6-pack in the shop, in the store, of 2-liter bottles. So when it's sort of wrapped together in that plastic, that is roughly the size of a sa'a. So a rova, which means a quarter, is a quarter of a kav. So a quarter of a 2-liter bottle is a 500cc bottle. So think of a small bottle of Coke, whatever, a quarter of a 2-liter bottle. That is what we're talking about over here. So a base rova means the amount of land in which one would normally plant that quantity, let's say 500cc, of seeds, let's say of wheat seeds to plant a wheat field. So the math kind of works out like this, that there's a measurement called the base sa'a, and that's the most standard used area measure of area of a field for large areas. So a base sa'a is the amount of land in which one could plant a sa'a worth of seeds. So you do the math. If there are 6 kav in 1 sa'a, and of course there are 4/4 kav in a kav, so then how many quarter kavs are there in a sa'a? It's 6 times 4, 24. So this is 1/24th the size of a base sa'a, is the base rova. And the base sa'a is given as 50 by 50 amos, 2,500 square amos. So an am is roughly half a meter. So you're saying 25 by 25 meters, say, you know, 625 square meters, or like something around, you know, say 5,500 square feet, something like that. So we're now, but we're dividing it by 24. So 2,500 square amos divided by 24 is just over 100 square amos. It's actually 104 and a 6 square amos to be exact. Or roughly 25 square meters, something like that. So that's the amount of size, according to the first opinion of Rabbi Lezer, of how big a field must be in order for it to be obligated in the mitzvah of payah. He gets that because he equates the field referred to in the verses with respect to payah to a reference to field with kilaim, sort of beyond the scope of right now what I want to get into, but the an important measure in kilaim is a base rova, so we're bringing in that measurement over here too. It's a little too technical for our purposes now, the exact derivation. Fine. That's the first opinion. The second opinion is Rabbi Yoshua, and he says, ha'osa sasayim. Rabbi Yoshua says, the amount of field which produces 2 sa'a. So Rabbi Eliezer, the first opinion was focused on how much seed would go into the ground, the input, if you will. This is Rabbi Yoshua focused on the output of the land. So it has to be a field that can produce 2 sa'a, roughly, if you remember a second ago, I said it's roughly 12 liters per sa'a. So 2 sa'a is basically 24 liters of grain. And that's the minimum amount. And Rabbi Yoshua gets this because sa'asayim, 2 sa'a, is a significant measurement with regard to the limits of shichah, also a little beyond the scope of what we want to discuss right now. But in any case, he's linking the rules of Shichcha to the rules of Peah, because they're in the verse, they're connected. And just like by Shichcha, there's an upper limit of 24, there'll be a lower limit of 20, excuse me, of Sasayim. So there's also going to be a lower limit of Sasayim to Saw for the production of the Eid field in order for it to be Chayiv and Peah. Rabbi Tarvin, the third opinion, Omer, Shishal Shisha Tfachim. He says it's just 6 by 6 Tfachim. A Tefach is a hand breadth. So 6 Tfachim is basically an Amma, the length from your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. So we're talking roughly half a meter. So basically half a meter by half a meter, an Amma by an Amma, 6 by 6 Tfachim. And that's all the same size. And Rabbi Tarvin says that's the minimum size of field it could be in order to be required to leave Peah. He gets it also from Kilayim, but this measure of 6 by 6 tefachim is a rule, as a size of a field that's relevant for the laws of Kilayim with respect to like a vegetable patch or like a small patch of herbs, etc. In any case, beyond the scope of ours for now, but in any case, he's equating a measure of a small patch for, let's say, herbs, whatever it is, with the rules of Kilayim, which is 6 by 6 tefachim. He'll apply that now to the rules of a field when it applies to Peah, 6 by 6 tefachim. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, the fourth opinion, Omer, he says, "Gdeliksor velishnos." He says, just the field needs to be big enough that you could start reaping it and go back for a second cut in the field. The idea here is we're not equating it to a particular size of field, but rather since the requirement for pay is to not complete your harvest, go all the way to the edge of your harvest once you started it. So once you start harvesting, there's a chiv of pay kicking in, and therefore you have to leave something. So as long as you can start a harvest and not be finished in one fell swoop, then you must really leave some pay at the end. That's why he says, deliktor, if you can start reaping something, and lishnos, if there's a second amount to reap, that already could be chayv and peah. V'halachat k'dvarav, the Mishnah here says that the halacha follows Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, that there's no minimum size in a field beyond just big enough that you could liktor v'lishnos, go at it twice, and with a reaping effort. And the Mishnah says the halacha is like him. This is quite uncharacteristic of the Mishnah. The Mishnah hardly ever paskins like anyone. And you should know that the rule is we don't paskin according to the Mishnah. So, and that's true throughout. So just because the Mishnah says that's the halacha, it may not be the halacha. And in fact, in this case, the Rambam, etc., do not paskin like this Mishnah. So the halacha is actually not kedvarav, not like his words. Rather, the halacha is going to follow this fifth opinion of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva Omer, karka kol shehu chayavas bepeya. Rabbi Akiva says, there is no minimum size for a field. Any field of any size is obliged to peah. That is to say, if you even had a single stalk growing in a field, it's that tiny, you know, it's like a, whatever, a square centimeter with one stalk growing on it, you could, in theory, harvest, you know, one branch of the ear of grain and then leave the other branch of the single stalk as peah. That's the halach, like Rabbi Akiva. There is no minimum. Once you start harvesting, you got to leave whatever, something, regardless of the size of the field. So that's kol shehu. Kol shehu means any amount. So now, the Mishnah will depart from our main topic and just point out that there are other, this is Rabbi Akiva, but we'll point out that there are other areas in halacha where you need land, and in these areas where land is required for some reason or other, there's no de minimis requirement, no minimum amount of land, any amount of land will do. So in addition to peah, which has no minimum requirement, any amount of land will do, so too with bikurim. Bikurim is the mitzvah bring the first fruits of the Shivat Haminim, the seven species by which Eretz Yisrael is praised, to the Beis HaMikdash, but they'll be given to the Kohen, waved and eaten over there by him. So your first fruits must be not only your fruit, but grow on your particular land. The verse requires it's your land on which it grew, so you have to have some land, but how much land? No requirements, even if you have a tiny piece of land, and that tiny piece of land is where that tiny piece of fruit grew, or grain, whatever it is, then it's, you can do the mitzvah of peah. It's a little technical, but in as much as obviously a tree is bigger, needs more space, et cetera, but that's beyond the scope of us. For right now, if you have barley or wheat growing on a tiny piece of land, you can bring bikurim on that because you own that piece of land. That's all you need. And similarly, there's no minimum requirements for lichta v'le'a prusbol. Prusbol, way beyond the scope of our topic right now, we'll get to it in Shvius, is a legal loophole that the rabbis set up whereby a person can prevent his loans to the poor during the Shemitah year from being relinquished and released. So the way it's done is also technical, and I don't want to get into it right now, but it requires that the borrower own some piece of land. for whatever reasons. And that means that if he owns any amount of land, it doesn't matter, that would be sufficient for effecting a prosbul that would prevent one's loan to that borrower from being released during Shemitah. We'll get the prosbul at the end of Masechah Shviyas. Veliknos ima nechasim she'en lemachrayas, but kesef, uvishtar, uvachazaka, the final thing listed in the Mishnah of where any amount of land will do to effect some legal requirement. So this is talking about what's called kinyan agav, a piggyback kinyan, let's call it. That is to say, the way in which one acquires movable objects, chattel, metaltalin in Hebrew, is usually by lifting it up, hagbah or meshicha, but let's say hagbah, just lifting it up. So, but not, for example, by transferring money. So, for example, if I'm purchasing your watch, just giving you the money doesn't make it mine. I have to actually physically take the watch and lift it up. Now, and the transfer of money effectively doesn't do anything in terms of a kinyan, in terms of transferring ownership, effecting the transfer. Right. So there is a rule, however, for the kinyan agav, the piggyback kinyan, which is once I'm transferring to you a piece of real estate as opposed to chattel, meaning a piece of land as opposed to movable object. So, and those are called in Hebrew nechasim sheyeshna machrayas, which is a property that has the ability to have a lien put on it, achrayas, responsible to a lien, encumberable. So the way one transfers ownership of land, real estate, is not through lifting it up, of course, because you can't lift up land. It's through either kesef, money, transferring, you know, transferring from my hand to your hand the money, or bishtar with a contract, uvachazaka, or through showing conclusively you own the land by doing an act that only an owner would do to the land, like building a fence around it or something like that. In any case, so once I'm transferring to you my land, so then I can have, let's say, in the contract or the agreement that when I give you the money or give you the contract, you'll acquire not just my land, but also some other, my watch, let's say. So that's called the piggyback. The watch piggybacks on with the rest of the land. And now when I use money, let's say, we can do an exchange of money to effect the transfer of ownership of the land. And with it, the watch can come along also. That's the kinyan agav, that's the piggyback. So if there were no land in the equation, if we changed money, that wouldn't transfer ownership of my watch from me to you. But if we are transferring money, exchanging money to transfer ownership of land, we can use the kinyan agav to also let the watch transfer along to you with the exchange of money. So how much land is required to effect the kinyan agav, this piggyback kinyan? The answer is any amount of land. There's no minimum requirement. And that's what the words, I'll read it to you one more time so you can see it inside. It says, Veliknos ima nechasim she'en lemachrayas. You can use any amount of land to acquire with it nechasim she'en lemachrayas. That's chattel, movable object that you can't put a lien on. You can do that, effect that transfer with kesef, money, shtar, contract, or v'chazaka with an act of showing ownership of on the land. And then the movable would transfer with it. Again, halacha like Rabbi Kiva, all these things.
Mishnah Peah, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Aleph, 7:1. So we're finishing up here the halachas of shicha, forgotten produce in the field, and we're going to talk about trees today. So the Mishnah starts by saying, "Kol zayis sheyesh lo shem b'sadeh." Any tree that has a name, like a known tree, specific tree. Filu kazayas and a tofu b'shato, the sort of filu might not belong, but like the particular tree called zayas and a tofa. Either this was the dripping tree. Either it's a specific place called Natofa. I feel like there's a place called Natofa around here somewhere, right? I think I've seen it on the street sign Natofa. There's a place called Natofa somewhere in Israel for sure. And there's a place called Natofa in Tanakh. So the Rambam learned it's a particular kind of olive tree, a particular place, or Bartner learned it means a tree that was so productive, and its olives are so productive that oil dripped like from the olives themselves. So it's like, you know, the point is Bishato in its day, like in its heyday, meaning that tree that once upon a time used to produce olives that were like so full of oil it dripped. It's like a famous tree, so to speak. So the idea is Shechacho, if you forget harvesting from that tree, Eino Shecha, it's not considered Shecha. Here's the idea. The idea is, if the tree is famous to you, so then sooner or later you'll be sitting around the dinner table And he'll be talking about like, oh, how did the harvest go this year? What happened? You know, how much olives came out of good old, you know, old oily. That famous tree. And then you'll say, what? Oh, I forgot that. You know, you'll remember it. You'll go back to get it. So kind of the same way, I guess, that, you know, people have, you know, like, I think, you know, we, if you work on a farm or something, so like there's like, you know, 1,100 cows, but everyone has a name for each cow at the zoo. Everyone has a name. It's like, so to speak, if you're a farmer, I guess you have names for the trees. Maybe not every tree, definitely not every tree, but those particular trees that are noteworthy, I guess, you know, are noted in your mind. So that's the idea. If it's a famous tree, then even in your mind famous, you won't forget it, and therefore it's not shifta. So, v'vedvar morim, when does this apply? What kind of examples? Bishmo, it has a name. B'masav, it has like famous acts. Or b'makomo has a like memorable location. So bishmo, what would it mean to have a memorable name? Shahaya Shifchoni o Beishani. Its name was Shifchoni, you know, the old oily, you know, the pouring tree, the tree that dripped oil, something like that. So since it's, you refer to it by name, by your pet name, so you won't forget it. Or Beishani. So Beishani, there's two pshatim here. Either means it like put the other, like busha kind of. It put the other trees to shame. So it's again like a famous tree. Doesn't translate exactly. Or Beishani, it could be from Russian, like either busha, it's humiliated by the other trees, or bish, it's like a bad tree. The point is that these pshatim have it, not a biblical locus, these pshatim have it that this tree is not a good tree, it's like famously terrible. So it's notorious. Either way, the point is, since you have a name for the tree and you can refer to it by name, sooner or later you're going to discuss how the tree did this year, and that means you'll remember it, so it can't be forgotten. But ma'asav, its actions, that means it's a famous tree, shahu osaharbet, for example. It's the tree that's known to do very well. Just, you know, you're a harvester, you'll remember that amazing tree that never lets you down. So the point is, it has no name, but you'll say, oh, I forgot to get the harvest from that tree that never lets me down, for argument's sake. So then you remember the tree. Obum komo, could be it's in its place. That means, for example, shu omid b'tzad ha-gas or b'tzad ha-pirtza. Like, for example, it's located next to the gas, is the wine press. And the pirtza is like the break in the wall. Pirtza, yeah, break. Yeah. So the idea again being that like you're just a memorable tree because of its location. It's that tree by the wine press. So sooner or later you'll think, oh gosh, I forgot to harvest that tree by the wine press, and you'll remember. Therefore, it can't have shichta. There's a bit of a kasha here, which is, if you recall back in the sixth parak, we had the case of Beis Hillel saying, if you pick up a sheet and put it down by the memorable location, then it's, at least according to Beis Hillel, it could still be shichta, right? So in here we're saying if it's in a particular location, it can't be shichta. So the answer is, it's a big difference between like where the wall is permanently located and the tree is permanently located. It's like it's the tree by the wall, as opposed to something you happen to put down by the wall. That's not as permanent according to Beis Hillel by any means, and therefore it is forgettable. So
it's not intentioned by the person doing the thing. In other words, if you left it
to
him, it's not intended.
I don't know what you're asking. Yeah, I was trying to figure out. That mission, this mission over here, one more time. This mission over here is simply saying, if you have a tree, we're talking about trees, and the tree has a particular location, like it's a noteworthy location, so much so that sooner or later you'll ask yourself or ask your fellow harvesters, what happened with that particular tree in that particular location? Like, you can refer to it specifically. So it won't be shichta, because you'll remember that tree as part of the harvest. Someone will say, oh, I forgot to do it. So then you will remember, so it's not going back yet. It wasn't forgotten all the way. Because it's a famous tree. Noteworthy tree, yeah.
If someone says to you, hey, you know that big tree by the lake?
But even that, yeah, even that. We have three options. Either it has a name, shmo, it has a particular name anywhere, or b'masav, produces in a noteworthy way, or Bumkoma has a noteworthy location. Any of those things. I mean, just to take a step back. We're talking about you have a whole orchard full of trees, so you normally wouldn't refer to them individually. Like, why would you? Except for your pet tree, for whatever reason. It's your pet project, your pet tree. It's the tree you'd laugh at every year because it does something particular, or looks funny, or is located somewhere funny. This is just a particular tree you have a name for, or a particular identity with. So since you have an identity for this particular tree, you won't forget it. That's all we're saying. So then that's period. That's the story. So the third example is, if the location is memorable, specific, it's that tree in that particular location by the wine press, you'll similarly refer to it as the tree by the wine press. So then I ask, I'm repeating myself. In the sixth parak, Mishnah Beis, it said that Beis Hillel held, if you picked up a bundle of wheat and you put it down by the wine press, that it could be shichcha. Beis Shammah said it can't. Beis Hillel said it could. So we had two pshatna, but according to the pshat that it's straightforward, it's straight kasha, then it's a kasha to this Mishnah, because this Mishnah is saying the tree by the wine press is not forgettable. And that Mishnah, according to Beis Hillel, the halacha says the Fargan take the wheat bundle by the wine press is forgettable. So what's the difference? So I'm answering that this tree like lives in a permanent place by the wine press. That bundle, you put it down somewhere. It's like, you know, who has to put their glasses down? Yes, you put your glasses down by the, you know, on the coffee table, but you don't remember 5 minutes later where you put the glasses down. It doesn't matter. You put it down a particular place. It's lost to you. That's the same idea that you put this bundle down thinking, don't forget, I put it by the wine press. But of course, 5 minutes later, you can easily forget it. Not the same thing as the hook where your keys belong, where you know to go to the hook because it's by the front door. You don't forget that. So that's the difference. The tree that lives by the wine press has a permanent home, so you won't forget it. The bundle you happen to put down by the wine press just happens to be there. At least according to Beis Hillel, it's forgettable. Fine, that's the difference. Ushar kol hazeisim, as for other olive trees, Shnaim shechcha or shlosha en shechcha. Just like we had previously when it comes to bundles of wheat and other things, you can only have one or two in sequence that are forgotten. If you forget three in a series, it's not shechcha. That's according to Beis Hillel. That was based on the drasha la'ani v'lager tazovotam. You're leaving it for the poor people and the converts. Two categories of people, two packages, not a third package. And Beis Shammai, not mentioned here, had three because they had the ani as well as the ger as well as the yasum and almana. Okay, fine. So that's the story here. If you have shar kol hazeisim, other non-memorable trees, olive trees, shnayim shichcha, shloshim ein shichcha, if you have two in a row that you forgot to harvest, that shichcha, if you forgot to do three in a row, it's not shichcha. And Rabbi Yossi Omer, ein shichcha lezeisim. Rabbi Yossi says, zeisim are exceptional. Now the pshat here, at least according to the Bartanura, which we'll stick to for now, is that Rabbi Yossi lived in the time of the Hadrianic persecutions, and Hadrian was a nasty guy. So he had all the olive trees cut down. So there were olive trees were hard to come by. That being the case, in Rabbi Yossi's day, just how could you forget an olive tree? It doesn't make sense. You know, just they're not forgettable because they're so specific. They're rare, they're valuable, just so, you know. So because of that, they're just not forgettable. So the halacha, according to Bartimaeus, that there's no such the sentence halacha is like or not like doesn't even apply here. I mean, the halacha might have been like him in his day, but to nowadays, I mean, even Rabbi Yossi would agree in a day where olive trees are plentiful, the whole thing doesn't get off the ground, you could have shichcha by an olive tree. So that's that. Here we are, small, we're famous. I don't know what we're famous for, but here we go. We're going to have to charge for this. Okay, Tov, that's the end of that.
I'll tell you, great. It's her right to claim from the Ksuba of the other lands when that eventual distribution formally occurs. Halach, however, is not like Rabbi Yossi. Halach is like the Tana Kama, that it needs to have been formally gifted and clear what portion of land she's getting in order for her to relinquish her rights to her general Ksuba. Again, Machlokas between the Bartanura, that her silence is consent, and the Rashbam, that you need to verbally agree to that new allocation. Okay, we're holding Maseches Peah, Perek Gimel Mishnaches 3:8. This Mishnah, again, is off-topic of Peah. The reason it's brought here is because, again, it uses the phrase karka kol shehu, some de minimis amount of land. The topic has to do with freeing one's slave in a way that's ambiguous. Now, to explain what that means, we're talking here about an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani, as opposed to an Eved Ivri, is a non-Jewish slave. The person started out being non-Jewish, and now they're owned by the Jew. I don't discuss too much about how that works, but suffice it to say that now this person became a separate status, like a quasi-Jew, called an Eved Kanani. And the Eved Kanani is owned by a Jew. That is to say, his person is owned, the same way other chattels, other objects are owned, or real estate is owned. So too, this person is owned by the Jew. That's the legal setup of an Eved Kanani. Again, I don't discuss here the ethical issues and how that works. And so just that's the legal issue. Now, if a person is an Eved Kanani, since they're owned, their person is owned by their master, the Jew, so they don't have the ability to acquire something for themselves. They haven't got a hand to acquire it, so to speak. That is to say that if I'm the owner and I give to my Eved Kanani, my slave, $100, say this $100 is for you, I want you to have it. So he has no legal way to acquire it. That's just a big joke. In other words, $100 which goes into his hand remains my $100. There's no possibility of an Eved Kanani making an acquisition in any way because he's an extension of me. He's owned by me. He's a wholly owned subsidiary of me, so to speak. So if one is to free his Eved Kanani, that emancipation requires a legal document. The same way there's a get, a bill of divorce that goes to a woman that would sever the marriage relationship. So there's a get shichrur, a bill of emancipation that severs the master-slave relationship. So if I want to free my Eved Kanani, my slave, I'll have to first give him some kind of get shichrur, an emancipation document that allows him to be free. Now, the normal way to do that would be have a document that expresses that very point, that I'm releasing you and you're becoming free. However, another way that could be done is by me giving him a document that says I'm transferring my ownership of his person to him. If I transfer my ownership of his person, so effectively he becomes his own owner of himself, and now he becomes a free man who can then, amongst other things, he becomes a full-fledged Jew, by the way, he can also acquire things like any other free man. And therefore, if I first give a document to my Eved Kanani, and I say, you're now, your person belongs to you. And I also say in the documents, for argument's sake, and with that $100 as well becomes yours from mine, and I give it to him, so that he now can acquire the $100 that becomes his, because he has the capacity to acquire. Our Mishnah discusses the question of valid or invalid declarations that we've written down in this Get Shechrur, in this Bill of Emancipation, and whether or not the Eved Kanani in such a scenario actually becomes free or not. So here we'll see it inside. The Mishnah says, Hakosav Nechasav La'avdo. If a person writes in the Get Shechrur, in that Bill of Emancipation, everything I own belongs to my Eved, my slave, Yatze Ben Chorin, then the slave goes free because included in everything I own is my rights to his person. And by transferring my rights to his person to him, he becomes free. And when he becomes free, he simultaneously acquires whatever else I'm transferring to him. In this case, everything. I could have just easily said, I transfer my rights in him alone and nothing else, in which case he'd become free and own nothing. Or I could say, I'm transferring to him my rights in his person plus $100, and he would acquire him his freedom plus $100. In this case, there's an unambiguous, I'm giving everything I own to him, and since everything includes the rights to his person, so his person transfers as well, and therefore he becomes free, and he goes free as well as owns everything I transferred. On the other hand, shir karka kolshehu, lo yatza ben chorin. If I say, I'm transferring everything I own to my slave, my Eved Kanani, except for something, except for some piece of land, for that matter, any other piece of property that I own, since I qualified the word everything, I said everything except for something, so now that everything doesn't mean everything literally, it means everything minus something, and that becomes ambiguous if included in that everything was also my rights to the person of the Eved, the ownership of the Eved Kanani himself. So that might sound a little strained at first, but the idea is that if I really want to transfer his freedom to him, then I would have said it. And since I didn't say it, all I said is I'm transferring to him everything I have minus something. It's not clear if I wanted to transfer my ownership to him also, if I was just sort of, wanted to make him feel good or play the fool with him or whatever the story may be. And therefore, since it's ambiguous, legally ambiguous, because I qualified the everything with everything except for something, maybe that something might include the rights to him, even though I only said something specific. Let me clarify that point. According to this, the Tana here, where I'm saying I write in the contract, Eved, I give you everything I own except for my farm. That alone would not render the Eved free, according to the Shita, Tanakama, because when I said everything except for the farm, maybe I meant everything except for the farm and your person. It's ambiguous what I meant, because everything didn't mean everything literally. So this Tana holds that Lo Yatzeh Ben Chorin, since it's not explicit that he's acquiring his freedom, therefore we won't let him acquire himself and become free. Rabbi Shimon disagrees. Rabbi Shimon Omer, La'olam hu ben chorin. Rabbi Shimon says that is not sufficiently ambiguous. If I say I'm giving you everything except for something in particular, so then all that's excluded is that something in particular, but included in the everything is the rights to the person of the slave. And therefore, when I say slave, I give you everything except for my farm. What that means is I give him everything, meaning including the rights to himself, and he goes free, and he owns all my property except for my farm. Rabbi Shimon says, however, there is a way it could be more ambiguous yet, and therefore the slave not go free. For example, ad shiyomer, if until the master writes in the document the bill of emancipation to the slave, hare kol nechasin asunin le'ish ploni avdi, I give all my property to my slave, chutz me'echer me'ribo shebehem, except for a tiny percentage of it. Ribo is 10,000, so echer me'ribo would mean 1/10,000th, you know, 0.01 of 1% of what I own. Of course, the Bar Tanura, what that means is, since I didn't specify which tiny sliver of my assets I'm not transferring, and it's ambiguous what that's referring to, it could very much mean a tiny sliver of my ownership of the Eved. And that being the case, the Eved didn't acquire his person free and clear, and therefore he acquires nothing, and he's totally still owned by me, and nothing transfers to him. According to Rambam, the meaning of this Echa Mirub Ribo Shebehem isn't that I'm transferring some indefinite, I'm transferring everything except for some undefined, you know, 1/10,000th of my assets, which might be referring to my ownership in him. Rather, what I mean is I'm transferring 99.99% of all my assets to him, meaning I'm retaining, you know, like, you know, so to speak, one share in my total ownership LLC, if you will. And since one of the assets in my total ownership LLC, so to speak, is the Eved, I'm retaining a tiny bit of my ownership in him also, along with my tiny bit of my ownership in everything else. So the two pshats in there. But we'll stick with the Bar Tanura as we always do, and therefore the Bar Tanura understands here, like the first way I said it, which is, since I was clearly withholding something from him and not clear what that was, so according to Rabbi Shimon, that would mean that it's ambiguous, and since the Eved can't go free and clear, he doesn't acquire his ownership, his freedom, he remains owned as a slave and acquires nothing. The halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon. That is to say, like the Tana Kama, if I say I give you everything except for something in particular, still that's not sufficient, because once everything didn't mean everything proper, we don't, it's called lo palgin and dibure, we don't start looking at it as two separate sentences, I give you everything and then with some qualification. No, it's everything, and everything didn't mean everything literally, mean everything except for something, and that remains ambiguous what that something was. Even if I was explicit in enumerating something to exclude at the farm, it may also mean everything but the farm and also some piece of you and your person. And therefore, that alone would be sufficient to not allow the Eved Kanani to go free.